Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
You've been in that introduction for 3 years.
I forgot where you could reach us.
Oh, my goodness. Were you out drinking last night or something? What was going on? Welcome, everybody. We have some fun stuff to talk about today. We have another good book we're going to be talking about. We have the author of a great coffee table book in the next segment of the show. But I want to start with some listener email today. By the way, I love you guys sending us listener email from all over the country.
Yeah, we haven't read enough of it. We need to get back to
it. And, you know, again, drop us an email, mark@stageleft.com or mark@restaurantguysradio.com or francis@restaurantguysradio.com. We love to hear from you from all over the country. It's really a lot of fun. We like to know where people are listening. This one from Houston. I'm an avid podcast listener from the Houston area with dreams of one day opening my own place. I'm a freelance writer and aspiring author who's working as a chef at an old restaurant in Galveston, Texas. This is from David. In your show featuring Tom Philpott, Francis, you mentioned that one should use canned pumpkin versus fresh when making pumpkin pie because it's just not worth it. I submit you are wrong. Everyone from the South knows the best pumpkin pie is made with sweet potatoes. It's a Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner staple at my grandmother's house in Louisiana. I respond, but isn't that a sweet potato pie? How do you make it?
In my family, we definitely call that a sweet potato pie.
All right, ready. So you didn't get the response that I got this morning before we came down. Well, it would be a sweet potato pie, but for years my grandmother let me eat dozens of sweet potato pies and lied to me and left me under the impression they were pumpkin pies. I've since grown up and had pumpkin pie, and I prefer a sweet potato pie any day and twice on Sunday. So, because your grandmother lied to you, did not make it a pumpkin pie. It's still a sweet, and by the way.
It's definitely sweet potato pie.
And I also agree with you, Dave. Sweet potato pie is delicious.
Yes.
I prefer it to pumpkin pie by three full measures. Are we ready to go on to more?
Please, we're ready to go.
Thank you for the email from Houston. Houston, we had a problem. I'm sorry.
Oh, my goodness. I hope you just thought of that
now. I did. And I didn't have time to rethink it and pull it back. That was the problem. Okay, we have a Travel and Leisure magazine did a survey of the most attractive cities, the most attractive people in America, most attractive cities in America, where the people are most stylish, most active, and most worldly. Philadelphia, lost.
Came in last.
Sorry, guys. I think Philadelphia is great, but yeah, they found the people there with the least stylish, least active, and least worldly. When questioned on it, Amy Farley, who is the editor of Travel and Leisure magazine who ran the survey, gave some consolation to the Philadelphian, saying that this was not a survey of unattractiveness.
Oh, thanks.
They were just the least attractive. Hey. Pittsburgh won the least attractive. Now, I'm going to get the hate mail now, too. I'm sorry.
Dude. An Eagles jersey never goes out of fashion.
That's true.
Come on.
In Philadelphia, it doesn't. Actually, there's some cool stuff going on in Philly these days. But there we are. That's Travel and Leisure magazine. Can't argue with the poll results.
Well, you can argue with the poll results, but people voted that way.
Ready for more silliness?
Yes, I have lots.
Not really.
Bring me some silliness.
This is actually said. Vincent De Domenico died on Thursday of natural causes at his home in California. He was 93. He was the inventor of Rice-A-Roni.
I see.
The San Francisco treat.
I know from where Rice-A-Roni comes.
It comes from game shows, where it was always the consolation prize. Those of you who are too young to remember that Rice-A-Roni...
did a lot of game show advertising.
By the way, that's pretty... No, you give away your Rice-A-Roni as the consolation prize? Yeah. You don't want to go home with a Rice-A-Roni. I mean, you know what I mean? So, he's the son of Italian immigrants. It was an Armenian recipe borrowed from a friend. He worked in his family's pasta business when he was inspired in 1958 to create the mix of vermicelli macaroni and flavorings. His uncle Tom's wife got the recipe from an Armenian neighbor and served it one night at dinner. His dad had been making dried soups for the army. When he tasted it, he said, maybe we can make something like this in dried form. Went back to the plant, messed around, and several years later,
Rice-A-Roni was born.
1986, they sold the company for $300 million.
In 1986, which means it's worth billions now.
Pretty cool, though, huh?
Billions of Rice-A-Roni.
You know, I remember there was a whole bunch of stuff that was inspired from that whole The Greatest Generation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were okay with spam.
Spam came I knew you were going to say spam. You know what? We didn't talk about this at all, but I would have bet $100 you were going to say spam.
My mom used to occasionally make stuff like chip beef on toast.
Really?
Yeah. Never in my lifetime.
Really?
But it wasn't allowed in the house.
My mom never made anything like that.
Your mom's Italian. My mom's Irish. But actually, I guess it can be kind of good, but literally my dad forbade it. Because on Okinawa, that's pretty much what they had every night.
Chip beef, lots and lots of chip beef.
But he did bring back a sea ration from World War II that we opened in like 1995.
Oh, man. And how was that?
It was still fine. It was
really?
Dried biscuits and a thing of water and, you know, the meal's ready to eat now, come in little plastic packages.
Uh-huh.
This is a big metal drum. I didn't have it down quite as well. Then. We didn't eat it. We were a little scared to eat it.
You didn't eat it?
No, I was like 40 years old.
So what? You said it was fine.
It looked fine.
No guts, no glory.
It looked okay. Do we want to talk about the meat recall now, or do we want to talk about that later?
Well, let's talk about it for a minute.
You know the Topps meat recall, one of the things that's very interesting about
22
it.
22 million pounds of beef were recalled.
There's a headline in, what paper is this? I guess it's the Times. Many red flags preceded a recall. You've heard us talk on this show a million times about the Food and Drug Administration's, the Department of Agriculture's close relationship with the industries they regulate.
It was, talking about the beef industry was one of the very first topics that we talked about in starting this show.
The way it works is the Department of Agriculture is purposefully toothless. They have, like, top executives from meat companies or companies that lobby for meat companies then become the head of the Department of Agriculture, who are then supposed to regulate the meat companies. And then when they're done that, they go back to work for the meat companies. So what kind of regulation do you think you're going to get?
It doesn't work that well, we don't think.
Well, and the Department of Agriculture is responsible to regulate meat, but they're also responsible to promote meat. So How does that work? Basically, they can't force a recall. They can't issue a demand for a recall.
There's no law. I mean, I think everybody thinks that FDA can come in and say, okay, pull all your meat off the shelves.
All they can do.
FDA does not have that power.
All they can do. Department of Agriculture.
I'm sorry.
All they're talking about is when they say there'll be a recall, they recommend that a company do a recall. And very often their recommendations are ignored. Delayed. And the thing about when you delay a recall, that meat is out there and some kid's eating it.
Right.
For that whole time. In response to
recall. And realize that the longer you delay a recall, the less meat ends up coming back to you.
Right. So it costs you less, but because more kids eat it. In response to problems, the Agriculture Department directed its inspectors on October 12th to conduct a nationwide survey of what meat plants are doing to fight E. coli, and it plans to send a special assessment team into any plants that seem to be lagging, and that special assessment team will urge them to adopt more stringent measures.
Urge.
And then this is hysterical.
Urge is right in the
it's above suggest.
Yes, urge, recommend.
When someone says we're a toothless tiger,
plead.
When someone says we're a toothless tiger and we're not doing anything, this is an example of something we're doing that I believe is making the food supply safe, said Dr. Raymond, who's the head of the Agriculture Department.
Yeah, it's a toothless tiger way is what it is.
If I were a toothless tiger, I
here,
would...
Here, Mr. Tiger, here's some oatmeal. That's what it is.
No, because if you're a toothless tiger, you can recommend that right. A gazelle lay down and die. If you're a toothful tiger, you just eat it.
Right.
So I would say that the Department of Agriculture is a toothless tiger by design, by regulation.
We need to make them more toothless.
And again,
we've talked about before, more toothful, right. There's some regulation out there to change that.
Well, it's not going anywhere.
Right.
It's not going anywhere at all. Democrats, Republicans, not going anywhere at all. But I got one. Here's the final shot. While government has long allowed meat plants to establish their own safety plans, Dr. Raymond added that we haven't shut the door on maybe setting mandatory standards. Thank heaven you're there, Dr. Raymond. Thank heaven.
To maybe not shut the door about maybe putting maybe standards.
You inspire us with confidence. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Yeah.
everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking today with Melanie Dene. She's a world-renowned photographer. Her work is featured in many publications like Town & Country, Vanity Fair, People, Gourmet, Newsweek. She has a couple of books out, Precious and A Journey of Smiles. She joins us today to discuss her latest work, a book called My Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and Their Final Meals.
Hey, Melanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Are you sort of a morbid person by design, or is that just, have you always been that way? What a crazy idea for a book.
It depends on who you ask, actually. Some people might say I'm morbid. Some people might say I'm just hungry.
But the last meal, you know, I think that's there's a little morbidity. You know, people don't realize that this is a game that chefs play. This is a game that we in the restaurant business mm-hmm. sort of, okay, Last Supper, what are you going to have?
Whether it's Last Supper or Perfect Meal, whichever.
Yeah, Mark's a little phobia about that.
Yes,
so he never plays the game, but most guys play the game. Now, how did you come up with the question, and how did the chefs react to you asking it?
Well, I came up with a question. Actually, that question, what would you have for your Last Supper, has been around for years. So I kind of wanted to flesh it out and get deeper and deeper. And in fact, when I first thought of doing this book, I honestly had no idea that this was a game that chefs played. I just noticed that what they ate and what they sort of did when they were off duty was not what they were doing when they were in their restaurants,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of fascinating. So I decided to ask them questions both about food, music, location, because I wanted to disarm them a little bit and not have it completely focused on the food and try to get sort of a bigger picture of what this last moment would be like.
Yeah, I've seen more than one famous chef clandestinely at the White Castle after a shift.
Exactly. Well, my dear friend Tony Bourdain said the other night, a lot of you are just liars. In other words, maybe the answers that they've given me are not always the answers that they give. Maybe the answers change.
Oh, I think, first of all, I do think they change. And there were definitely some people saying, well, I would have a meal cooked by my chef at my restaurant.
Exactly.
And it would be a perfect meal of caviar and foie gras. When maybe deep down what they were thinking was, you know, some sliders and fries.
Well, exactly.
No, you know, it's funny.
And a cold chocolate shake.
I think that a lot of people did answer honestly, and I don't know that, you know, you can answer the answer if you were actually faced with the question would be the same as when it's presented to you in the abstract. But I think what's interesting is a lot of people went for simple meals, talking about being mm-hmm. home with their kids or you know just the things that remind them of their youth. I really like Daniel Boulud. He basically, his photograph is of him in a tuxedo outside the palace at Versailles, and he's drowning in an ocean of caviar and foie gras. Good for you, Danielle.
Exactly. Cooked by Alain Ducasse.
Exactly.
Well, he's not messing around.
When you talk about your book, and one of the very first things that I noticed was the juxtaposition of Daniel Boulud in his tuxedo standing in front of Versailles. And just a few pages before that, you have a picture of Tony Bourdain standing naked, basically with a beef femur covering up his essentials. Two very different pictures that you've put in your book there, and I think they both capture the person's personality pretty well.
Well, thank you, and that honestly was my goal. What I did was I gave each person the answers, and some of them wanted to answer in person. Some of them, we did it over lunch. Some sent me the email, you know, they emailed me before. And from their answers, I tried to take a thread, and that's how I thought of the pictures. And then I went back to them in some cases and said, you know, at 2 o'clock on Tuesday, see you then. And I didn't really elaborate. But, of mm-hmm. course, to get to Versailles, Daniel and I had to do a bit of planning, shall we say. In fact, I carried his tuxedo overnight on the plane and I wrote all over my hands, do not forget tuxedo. Do not forget tuxedo.
Good thing they weren't taking a picture of you.
Yeah, no kidding.
I have to say my favorite picture in the book, this is a coffee table book by a great photographer, and it's primarily a book of photographs. But it also tells a story and is a great snapshot of what some of the greatest culinary minds around the world are thinking. I have to say, I was recently at Versailles, and it's one of the most beautiful places in the world as far as an elegant, you know, it seems to be the height of fine dining, you know, Western culture decadence. And to see Daniel Boulud with a glass of champagne standing on the steps in a tuxedo looking a little like James Bond – is really rich. Do you have a favorite photo in the book?
Oh, there's so many I love. I love the Lydia Bastien. I love the pasta hat.
Oh, with the pasta hat. It's a great one.
I think this hat is incredible. Yeah. I love the simplicity of Eric Ripert's picture because, you know, his food and his entire world is so much fancier. But really, intrinsically, he's a very simple dude.
You know, we have to take a quick break and we'll come right back. But I do want to assure our listeners, if you buy this book, that Lydia Bastianich is indeed in this book wearing a hat made out of pasta. But it is dried pasta.
Yes, it is.
It would be very, very messy if
it
were, though.
It's not dripping wet.
It's quite stylish. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Melanie Dunay about her wonderful book of photographs of some of the best chefs in the world. It's called My Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and Their Final Meals. These portraits are pretty wild, and to have these portraits and right next to them have the chefs discuss what they'd have for their final meal, what music they'd be playing, who they'd be dining with, is pretty interesting. It's actually a lot more interesting than it sounds when you actually see it. It's a pretty cool cross-section of where food is in Western culture today, or at least where chef-driven food is in Western culture today. But there was one chef that sort of politely declined to answer your query about My Last Supper, which is Guy Savoy, who said I can't answer your question, yet you included him in the book anyway. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I when I got Guy's letter, which was a handwritten, beautiful handwritten note, I couldn't believe it. I thought what he said was so beautiful, and I thought, well, that's the perfect answer to the question. I mean, he answered it in his way. It took a bit of convincing for me to, for him to allow me to actually publish it. Then I said, I'd like to take your photo, and I don't think he really knew what I meant. So I sort of went to Las Vegas. My plane was late. I arrived, and I just took a simple, simple portrait of him. And 5 minutes later, we were done.
But I think, you know, given what he said, and we need to tell our listeners a little bit.
Do you have the exact quote handy? I'll find
it. I actually do. I can redo the...
Would you?
The letter. It says, Dear Madame, I thank you for your note and I'm touched by your admiration. Nevertheless, I have a phobic rapport with death, and because of this, we'll never discuss my last meal. This returns me to my life's philosophy. I talk about openings, not closings. Receive, dear madame, my best wishes. Guy Savoy.
That's classic. That's classic.
You know, it's funny. The guy who didn't answer your question has maybe the most poignant answer in the whole book.
Exactly. Mm. That's exactly what I thought.
Well, it's a gorgeous book, and you can find out about it more on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and pick it up and make a good present to give to your foodie friends around Thanksgiving or around the Christmas and Hanukkah holidays. We'll be back after the news talking more with Melanie Dunay about her interactions with some of the greatest culinary minds cooking today and the beautiful picture she took of them. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
You've seen Melanie Denae's work in Town & Country, Vanity Fair, People Gourmet, Newsweek, yada, 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 yada. She has two books, Precious and A Journey of Smiles. She's here to discuss her most recent book with us, The Current Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and Their Final Meals. You know, in the introduction of the book, which was written by Anthony Bourdain, there's a great quote that I'd love to talk to you about. He says, if cooking well is about control, and all the people in this book are control freaks, then eating well is about submission. So it was really, you know, taking these controlling, dominant people and getting them to talk about what it would be like, what it's like for them to submit.
And some of them refused. What? Said, I will not submit, I'll cook my own.
But why did they answer you?
I was extremely persistent. And that is really the understatement of the day. I persisted and persisted and emailed and called and encouraged. And as soon as I got a good stable, I sort of dropped names. And, you know, nobody likes to be left out, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. But nobody wants to be first in something like this either.
That's true. Well, actually, no, I had a good group. I had photographed a few chefs before, and that's really how this all got started. I photograph all types, you know, all different genres of people, and the chefs were just willing to do anything. They were the most open. So I kept they kept having me back, thankfully, and that's sort of where the whole thing came about. And when I asked them to do this, they were all pretty open. There were a few refusals, but they were all pretty open.
When you spoke earlier about the simple photograph that you took of Eric Ripert, which is a wonderful photograph of a great, you know, laughing, smiling, amazing chef. And he's such an interesting-looking guy as well. How does that relate to his last meal, which he said I thought was great? Mm. He said, my last meal would be bread, olive oil, truffles, salt, and pepper.
Well, poor Eric. He was very, very kind and let me decapitate him on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
So the cover of the book, actually, there is the truffle, the olive oil, and the bread. And, you know, Eric is a very lovely, friendly, smiley guy. I always think of him smiling and laughing. So, but it's not necessarily, that doesn't come across necessarily in his food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lightness of heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought we'll just set up a little, you know, bread and have some fun. Bread and wine, and he can rip it apart, and it was fabulous. And that really is him to me. When I see that picture, that is him.
I thought that Guy Savoy's answer was very telling, and I thought that his answer was, you know, I mean, it's a hopelessly romantic, of course, but I thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. Here you have a guy who has, and Bourdain talks about in the introduction to the book, have, you know, the great chefs of the world have access to food. It doesn't matter how rich you are, it doesn't matter how worldly you are, the great chefs in the world, who all sort of know each other, you call up, you know, if you're going to be in Spain, you call up Fran Adrià and you go and eat with him at the chef's table. Mm-hmm. If you're in
Absolutely.
That club. So they've eaten the best food in the world. It's a regular thing for them. And to see when some of these guys wanted to return to, you know, bread, olive oil, you know, salt, pepper, and truffles, which are, you know, a little decadent, admittedly, I thought there's something very, very nice about that.
It was also interesting to me. Did you see how Laurent Tourandel wanted Krispy Kreme donuts?
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, I didn't think that was so nice. I loved Laurent Tourandel, and I think he's a great chef. But I'm not a trans fat guy.
See, I'm the donut crazed.
If he wanted to make his own donut, I would appreciate it. But I get it.
I'm the guy who donuts would be
well,
on the page.
And who the hell am
for
I?
For sure.
And who the hell am I to criticize?
I agree. Who the hell are you?
Who the hell am I to criticize his last meal? You know what I mean? He wants Krispy Kreme donuts. Let him have them.
But
know?
Can I tell you that when we did go to the last remaining Krispy Kreme in New York City, that dude ate 50 donuts.
No way.
I am not kidding you.
Now I respect him.
It's true. I mean, he loved Krispy Kremes. He was like a child in a candy store.
Well, you know, the Krispy Kremes used to have the blue light, and you'd know when they were coming out of
That's
the oven
right.
down south. That's a whole different thing than New York. They were like at Port Authority in a box that were delivered last Tuesday.
Well,
you know,
except I don't know if you saw the picture. He's eating them off the conveyor belt.
For those of our listeners who don't know, the Krispy Kreme company, they were the southern Dunkin' Donuts, and what they had was they had a blue light outside. And so if you're driving by a Krispy Kreme and the blue light's on, it means the donuts just came out of the oven. turn around, even if it's your rearview mirror, go back and get a Krispy Kreme. One of the reasons they failed is when they expanded so quickly, you know, you'd be in Port Authority and there were Krispy Kremes on display that had been delivered no blue light, there's no oven in sight, you know, so that's why they failed.
But they do, the sign up on the Upper East Side does turn bright red.
It does?
Yeah, they do turn it on when the donuts are, because I'm telling you, they flood in. People flood in.
I would. I'm not a big fan of Krispy Kremes unless they're right out of the oven. That's the key. Hey, let's talk about another chef that I visited recently who I think is great. And I was at her restaurant. We're talking about Hélène Darroze.
Oh.
I was at her restaurant the week it went from 1 star to 2 stars several years ago. And then I was just back there again in early September. And I met her through a friend that she mentioned to the book, Ariane Degan, who sells foie gras here in New York. Had a wonderful meal with her. She's an interesting story, and she's there aren't as many women in this field as men. And she's in France. She's a 2-star chef. She's the daughter of a 3-star chef, and I think the granddaughter of a 3-star chef. And she's a very unique take on food, very traditional. And your picture of her has, you know, butterflies and lights, and it's very pretty. How did you come up with that picture? And what's the story behind it?
Well, Hélène didn't. We were meant to meet in Biarritz, and our schedules didn't coincide in the last minute, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to sort of scurry and figure out what we would do for our next, Plan B, which sort of happened a lot, and I decided that I would go to her. Well, she actually decided that we would shoot in her restaurant.
Uh-huh.
So I searched all over the restaurant and found this amazing wall with butterflies all over it. And I love, you know, she's one of the few chefs that wears that Fufu Chef toque.
The old-fashioned toque like the Muppets used to wear.
Exactly.
The chef on the Muppets.
So
the Swedish chef wore that
exactly.
One.
So I just thought, you know, to make her look ethereal and her food is so traditional, I thought this would be a nice contrast.
So, you know, we have this great picture, and obviously this is a collaboration between you and the chef. Is that what happened in most of the pictures? Were they collaborations between you and the chef, or did you, based on their answers, kind of have an idea of what you wanted to take?
Oh, I had an idea down to the T. I mean, I took a pig's head to Fergus Henderson.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I had a British flag steamed up and ready for Jamie Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
I had the beef bone ready. I completely choreographed every single shot.
And for those of you who don't know Melanie, I mean, Melanie is a world-class photographer, and that certainly comes across in this book.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you.
One of the things that's interesting about this book is we talk all the time. We interview chefs, farmers, and many authors of different stripes, whether critics or textbook writers, food scientists, or cookbook authors. The way of the cookbook has sort of changed, and all cookbooks sort of have a story. They're not a collection of recipes anymore, or they have a binding theme that brings them all together, and it's sort of these recipes are woven around a story.
Right. Rarely do you see a Joy of Cooking anymore where it's just a collection of recipes.
Absolutely.
Now, your book is a book primarily about photography and taking a mental cross-section of these chefs by asking the same question to all of them and looking at their different answers. But you also felt compelled to include recipes. Is this sort of, now it's hard to write a book about food without including recipes? Is this the other side of that coin? Why did you include the recipes?
Well, I was sort of encouraged to include them. Before I even signed with my publisher, Bloomsbury, every single person I met said, you have to have recipes, you have to have recipes. So I resisted it at first. But then when actually people started to write their recipes, and most of them are original. You know, Wiley Dufresne takes this loose hamburger and walks down to the corner store. You know, there's a bit of stream of consciousness. And I loved that.
You know, I think that also when recipes are there and they're from individuals and they are unique recipes, I think that also adds to the shelf life of a book, because I think while a lot of cookbooks sit on the shelf for a long time, I think for certain people, like me, a book like this, I'll go pick a recipe or two up out of there, but I don't know when I'm going to do it. So I sort of keep the book around, and it's sort of a whole part of my life.
Well, that's what's interesting is I actually don't cook. believe it or not. And I've been cooking the recipes. I have a little dinner party once in a while. And, for example, at Easter I had Gordon Ramsay's Last Supper. They are delicious.
Great. Well,
so now you cook.
We're gonna have to take a quick break, and Melanie, you figure out when you're gonna have Mark and I over for dinner.
Yes.
And when we come back, we'll set the date. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Melanie Dunay. We're talking about her book, My Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and the Final Meals.
So Melanie, in your book, you have a great picture of Gabriella Hamilton. I'm sure that's been talked about a lot with some of the people you've talked about. And basically, she's talking about her last meal, but she's there giving somebody their first meal. So would you like to discuss that photo at all and how it came about?
Well, Gabrielle's children mean so much to her, and she is such an amazing chef. And I just couldn't figure out from her answer, you know, how I was going to photograph her, and we contemplated going to Coney Island, and it rained every day. We weren't sure what to do. And then I just sort of got up the courage, and I emailed, and I said, how about breastfeeding your baby? Because in her actual meal, she says, you know, she speaks about that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that quote handy?
I do. I'm just looking for it. That's a very
nice. And a super tasteful picture, too. I mean, this is not, you know, anything other than very, very tasteful and sensitive picture.
She says, sure, you want me to read this?
Yeah, I do, actually.
I also love the perfect feeling when my boobs are brimming and Leone is very hungry and latches on with serious intention. When this works, it's blissful.
Now this is Gabrielle Hamilton, one of the top chefs in New York, talking about what she'd like her last supper to be, and she talks about what she'd like to do is feed her children. And she talks about how when her two-year-old really, you know, likes what she eats and eats what she cooks, that's, you know, that and also her infant, you know, that's a very seminal moment for a great chef. And that was a kind of a blow me away kind of a.
And speaking, you know, I didn't want her to lose dignity, so that's why obviously she's not totally naked. You know,
right.
I wanted her to still be the proud, the chef, the important, you know, because I think sometimes people get crazy with these naked pictures.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted
this is nothing that I think, you know, there's nothing exposed that you couldn't have on the cover of a magazine. You
exactly.
Know, so. But she is a very strong woman. And who has roots in New Jersey, by the way.
Oh.
Hamilton's Grill Room is her family down in Lambertville, New Jersey. It's her dad, I believe, and her restaurants are great. She is a great chef. Let's talk for a minute about, you know, it's not just what they'd eat that they discuss, but they discuss who they'd like to be dining with and what music they'd like to be playing. Were any of those answers surprising to you?
Well, a lot of them sort of, some said, I'd like to, you know, be with other chefs,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was really interesting. I mean, you had your token, I want to be with my family. But I loved how Danielle wanted Alain Ducasse to cook his last meal. And I loved how Michelle Bernstein said, you know what, I'm just going to be with my mom.
By the way, I want Alain Ducasse to cook my last meal as well. That's on my list for sure.
I'd like him to cook my next meal.
I was amused that, and we were just talking about both of these people, but Anthony Bourdain pretty much mentioned a bunch of dead people and Gabrielle Hamilton.
I know, that was wild.
Which was a little...
Marcus Samuelson, you know, he was funny because he wanted Martin Luther King and Gandhi.
You also photographed Marcus Samuelson with a fillet of salmon on his head. What did he do to you?
That That was one stinky day.
Now, we talk about Lydia Bastianich was photographed with a hat made of dried pasta, not wet pasta, but that was an actual side of salmon wrapped around Marcus's head.
And we were just laughing the other night. How did we attach it? We both can't remember how we got it to actually stay. But
maybe you use salmon slime.
Well, yeah, exactly. He is sort of the Ethiopian king in my mind. He's handsome, so we didn't need to sort of hide him.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of salmon there. We had different crackers there. We had a bunch of different food. But nothing worked more than this. And to hold it didn't look as good. Maybe I have a thing for thing on people's heads.
You definitely have a hat fetish. I'm 100% sure of it.
I think you should see someone and talk to them about that.
Well, Mario Batali had a hat as well.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking now. I must have a hat fetish.
Now, was there anything that surprised you, or more importantly, was there any sort of commonality? Now, the book is beautiful. The recipes are nice. But you got to ask some really important people, and because of where the culinary field is now in our culture, really important people in our culture, not just about a meal, but about, you know, what happens at the end. What is one question that was asked to all these people across the board? That's very uncommon. Did anything surprise you? Were there any commonalities that surprised you? What did you learn? What did you learn from this as the author?
Well, first of all, they all want to go near the water, which I thought was fascinating. I would say 2/3 of them want to have their last supper on a beach, near the beach, near the water.
And one of them wants to be on a boat.
Yes, Tetsuya wants to be on a boat.
So what's that all about?
I think it's just calm there. It's the antithesis of the kitchen.
Mm.
Think about the noises of the beach as opposed to the noises of a kitchen. They are definitely juxtaposed.
Especially if you're Gordon Ramsay. So I'm sorry, but did you have more? Were you going on with it?
Well, no, I was just going to say the one thing that I learned is the food that they represent in the kitchen and their restaurants is definitely not what they really want for their Last Supper.
Except for Danielle Boulud.
Yes.
Who I love that. Dying in a sea of foie gras and caviar.
Yeah.
See, I want like 21 courses just because I'm not ready to die yet.
I'm trying to put it off.
So bring me as many courses as you can possibly think of.
Well, the book is called My Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and Their Final Meals, Portraits, Interviews, and Recipes. It's by Melanie Dunay with an introduction by Anthony Bourdain. You can find out more about it and even pick it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Melanie, it's been a pleasure to have you on the
Thanks,
show.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you so much, you guys, and we will have to have that meal.
That's
Absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely. Well, you've got my email. We'll make that happen.
Okay. Cheers.
All right, so we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. You know, I have to say I had an experience just last week, on Friday, I had one of those eating tours of New York that we used to do more when we were younger.
Yes, we did them quite a bit then.
I had a friend of mine in who's the editor-in-chief of an Austrian wine magazine, a guy named Peter Schleimer, who's been on the show before. He's an authority on Austrian wine. He also owns an orchard in Austria. And he's a really cool guy. He came to stay with me for a couple of days and basically just shop and eat. It was awesome. Shop, eat, and drink, exactly. And I'll tell you, the euro is like $1.50. He's like, sure, I'll buy this, I'll buy that. You want something here? Usually with my guests, I don't impose. I'm like, all right, you can pick that up. Sure, because you're paying in euros. But we went out and we went to a couple of new places. One of the places we went to was owned by a guy named Peter Hoffman.
Mm-hmm. Just opened a brand new place.
Who owns Savoy Restaurant, has also been on this show before. I think he's one of the most important voices for sustainable and local food and who puts his money where the mouth is. I mean, Peter Hoffman is where the rubber hits the road, you know. And Savoy Restaurant is great in Manhattan. He's just opened a new place, very, very, very casual place, mm-hmm. all about local food, simple.
It's called Back 40.
It's called the Back 40. Mm-hmm. It's in Manhattan in the Village. We'll link you to it on our website. This is in the East Village, and it's casual, simple. I mean, plates at like $6 and $7.
And literally just opened. I mean,
and the wine list is great and inexpensive. And it's about sit down, sit at a communal table. The tables aren't stained, and all the tables are a different wood. Like one is ash, one is oak, one is walnut. And the idea is, they're not stained at all. They're not finished at all. And we were there on this fourth night they were open, and Peter came out and said hello. And so there were like
stains on.
Well, it looks like they're messed up right now because there are little rings on it. And Peter said, "Yeah, but in 2 months they won't look like they're messed up.
They'll just look like a conglomeration of.
And in 10 years they'll look pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is just who'd think of that? But Peter Hoffman.
You and I would like go berserk the first 2 months of. Oh, it doesn't look right.
Exactly.
It doesn't look right.
But it is. The food was great. The service was great. The wine list was great. And I say we don't really recommend restaurants very often.
Sure,
on the
we
show.
Do. I mean, we recommend them all the time.
Well, but if you're in Manhattan or you're around Manhattan, you want to go for a casual bite, wear your blue jeans, wear a cowboy hat and boots if you want, and be sit with other people. And just we ordered the whole menu. We had literally everything on the menu, and it was absolutely
that's shocking for you. You hardly ever
know,
do that.
And then we went out to dinner. I'm not kidding at all. In my younger, more vulnerable years, I would have been even hardier. But it was really great. So Peter Hoffman, Back 40, New York City. Check our website for it. I'll have it up later today, restaurantguysradio.com. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with us on The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.
We've been serving Central Jersey for more than half a...